You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm very pleased to have my first international guest on Heartland Politics. He's someone with a new book and a perspective that I think you'll see has some very pertinent parallels with the United States and of special attention to our listeners in this region. He's Paul Embry, and he's the author of a new book called Despised: Why the Modern Left Loathes the Working Class. Paul is a firefighter and trade union activist in England. Why is this important to our area? Because our politics in many ways have tracked Britain's for the past decade or so, and we may be seeing some other similarities in our current politics, especially leading up to the 2022 critical midterm elections here. Paul, thank you very much for your time to come on, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be with you.
Well, first of all, I'm very curious. It's interesting, your background, that I'd like you to share with your listeners, kind of with the area you grew up in your life, and what led you to this point to write this book.
Well, I grew up in a very working class part of London, the East End of London, a borough called Barking and Dagenham, and it was traditionally a very much a blue collar community. There was industry, there was the big local Ford Motor plant, and it was a place where there was a sprawling public housing estate, and it was never, you know, affluent in any way, but at the same time it was never poor. It was just a kind of solid, stable, working class, blue collar community. And these people in that community had over many generations voted for the British Labour Party because they saw the party as their party. They thought it was the vehicle by which they could advance their own interests, their own material well-being. And the Labour Party had delivered that over many years. You know, the Labour Party traditionally was the party that fought for working people in the corridors of power. You know, it fought for full employment, it fought for decent wages, it fought for public housing, strong public services, all of that kind of thing. But increasingly, it became clear to me over the last kind of 20 or 30 years that communities like the one that I grew up in were being increasingly alienated from the Labour Party. The Labour Party in Britain was moving from being a proud working class party to becoming increasingly a middle class party. A party that had embraced the kind of precepts of the new cosmopolitan liberalism, a party that increasingly had less affinity with ordinary working class communities, a party that was becoming a party more for the professional and managerial middle classes. And that created a huge disconnect. And over the course of the last 30 years, particularly in the second part of that period, the last 10 or 15 years really, working class voters in Britain have abandoned the Labour Party in huge numbers because they felt that the party had abandoned them. It became very woke, it became very liberal, it failed to understand the small C conservative instincts of millions of working class people. It looks upon communities like mine as a bit reactionary and a bit bigoted because, you know, they believed in traditional values. And that has left the British Labour Party now almost an irrelevance in British politics. And I think that's incredibly sad. And, you know, it's caused a huge shakeup in British politics. And it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out in the next few years.
I think our listeners will see the parallels between the Labour Party, as Paul described it here, and what's happened with the Democratic Party. I'm curious to have you talk a little bit about the warning signs. Your book talks about some of the early warning signs, and our listeners will tell how this parallels kind of what was going on in our country as well. But what was occurring that provoked the changes you saw in British politics, the economy, and the culture there?
Well, there were profound changes, and particularly, as I identify in the book, the first decade of this century. I mean, it is really difficult to overstate the very far-reaching changes that were sweeping through British working-class communities during that first decade. This was at a time when the Tony Blair Labour government was in charge in Britain. Tony Blair very much embraced the new global market. He was kind of very much in favour of a looser immigration policy. And in working class communities, what that really meant was deindustrialisation on a large scale. That's what the global market meant for many of those communities. It meant very rapid and far-reaching demographic change in some of those communities. And what we saw are communities that really didn't get the benefits of globalisation materially, socially, economically, spiritually, in the way that the more middle-class liberal elements of society saw the benefits and reaped the benefits. And what began to happen is when the disconnect began to emerge because of that, those people who raised concerns about these very profound changes that were taking place were often demonized, particularly by people on the left in Britain, as, you know, racist and nativist and a bit backward. And, you know, why can't these people see the benefits of this new cosmopolitan liberalism? And the sad thing is, I think these were often communities and people who were not opposed to change per se. I mean, they understood that society always changes. But we're just deeply uneasy about the very rapid and far-reaching scale of that change. And at that period, millions of people stopped voting for the Labour Party. Some of them just abstained completely in elections. Some of them went to populist parties like the British National Party, which is a far-right party, or the United Kingdom Independence Party. So this really has been building up. The disconnect between the left in Britain and the working class has been building up for many years. And we saw the outcome of it in the 2019 general election in Britain, where Labour was just frankly annihilated in parts of the country where it had won support for years and had won the seats, constituencies, since time immemorial. So the disconnect is profound for all the reasons that I've said.
And this was building up as globalization accelerated in the early parts of this century. And then, of course, everybody remembers the Brexit vote, which kind of foreshadowed the election of Donald Trump in 2016. It just seems, you know, and I want to reemphasize to folks that Paul is a member of the working class, grew up in a working class family, a member of the Labour Party. So he's got a license here, extra license, I think, to be critical of his party and the way things have transpired. I'm looking for other parallels here that I see, and the book talks about the Red Wall in England, and of course we had the Blue Wall in the United States, which Donald Trump was successful in tearing down. It was traditionally Democratic states here in the Midwest of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin when he won. If you could share with our listeners the Red Wall, what is that in Britain, and is there some similarities there?
Yeah, so the Red Wall, which is a term actually that was only fairly recently introduced into British politics in the last few years, but what it actually means is those parts of Britain that had traditionally always voted very heavily for the Labour Party had always returned Labour members of Parliament at general elections, had always voted Labour in local authority elections, and places where few people until just a couple of years ago could ever have imagined would ever return a Conservative MP. In some of these red wall places, the Conservative Party, the Tories in Britain, were traditionally regarded as the enemy, you know, the people who were never on the side of working class people and the people who should be resisted. And then in the 2019 general election, vast chunks of the Red Wall voted Conservative and returned Conservative MPs. And these Red Wall places are generally places in what I would call town Britain, post-industrial Britain, provincial Britain, the places that had an industrial past but have suffered heavily from deindustrialization, have suffered very rapid demographic change, and consequently have seen the Labour Party imposing much of that agenda on them, and thought, well, why should I vote for you now? And, you know, we had a saying in Britain that some of these places in the Red Wall, they didn't used to count the Labour votes, they just used to weigh them because they did vote so overwhelmingly for the Labour Party. But increasingly, as the Labour Party moved away from these people and these communities and you know, failed to understand the communitarian impulse in these communities, the desire for social solidarity, the traditional values that they often held, the sense of patriotism, the sense of belonging, as the Labour Party became much more a party rooted in, you know, the fashionable cities and the university towns of Britain, a party for student radicals and woke activists, social activists, etc., millions of these traditional Labour voters looked at the party and thought, you don't really look like me anymore, you don't sound like me anymore, you don't share my priorities. You tried to overturn the Brexit vote. We voted to the EU in 2016. The Labour Party at the 2019 general election had a policy where it said we should have a second referendum and go through it all again, whereas Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party said we'll get Brexit done, you know, we'll get it finalised and get it through. And I think the problem now, Robin, is some of these places have invoked Conservative for the first time. It's almost like that taboo has been broken. And having done it once, they won't hesitate to do it again. And I guess that, you know, I don't claim to be an expert on American politics, but it certainly strikes me that there are parallels in terms of, you know, some of those places that are traditionally voted for the Democrats and have seen the Democrats as their party. You know, places in the Rust Belt, which I guess is very similar to Britain's Red Wall, and thought, you know, actually you've become out of kilter with me. You know, you've become this kind of woke, very liberal-leaning organisation for the professional and managerial middle classes. You know, you don't represent me, you don't speak for me. And I imagine that it's a very, very similar phenomenon. And unless these parties, the Democrats and the Labour Party, show that they do understand these communities and they do understand what drove, you know, people in America to vote for Trump, people in Britain to vote for Brexit and the Tories in 2019, then, you know, I think they're in serious danger of losing those people and those communities forever.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author, firefighter, trade union activist Paul Embry, who's written a very provocative book called Despised, Why the Modern Left Loathes the Working Class. It's a book written, I think, with the proper intention of trying to help the Labour Party rediscover its roots in the working class and to be able to win again. And I think there are strong parallels to what's going on here with the Democratic Party in the United States. And we just talked about the Red Wall in England and then the Blue Wall here. And I think when you were describing these areas, you're basically in England, you're basically describing what's happened up and down the Mississippi River here in our region, especially in the Iowa side, where a lot of counties that were traditionally Democratic, post-industrial, if that's what you want to call it, have switched, and they've done it now for a couple of elections, voting heavily for Donald Trump. So there are some strong parallels here, and we're just trying to talk through this and what's happened over there, and whether it's a precursor or what's going to happen here. I'm curious, it seems to me that and I don't want to simplify this, but the loss of manufacturing jobs seem to me to be the start of this economic and social decline. I've seen it. I've experienced it where I live. And, you know, it's hard because a lot of people will just flippantly say, well, we can't bring manufacturing jobs back. We can't do that. But I don't know. Is it possible to do that? It seems that that would go a long ways towards rebuilding the economic and social foundations of these areas.
Yeah, and I think it should be a key priority for any government. The truth is we're never going to rise to the heights again of being the economic and industrial powerhouse and the manufacturing powerhouse that we were, you know, during the days of empire and later. Of course, it's a very different world now, and we face all sorts of different competitors. But, you know, the point is, as I say in the book, the likes of Germany and Japan certainly maintain much more robust and successful manufacturing bases than we do in Britain. So, you know, whether or not we're going to be able to ensure every job again, to repatriate every job that we've lost, of course, that's highly unlikely, but we can certainly do better than we're doing. And yeah, I think there's all sorts of reasons for why we're not doing well in that regard. I think in our own case, it's probably as a result of an overvalued currency, which I think has made us fundamentally uncompetitive on the world stage. I think that, you know, when you look at the impact, as you touch on in your question, of the loss of manufacturing, particularly in some of these provincial small town areas in Britain, which relied on manufacturing industry, which took pride in having thousands of blue collar, stable, steady jobs in their communities, to be replaced now often by, you know, what we call, I don't know if you have the same term in America, the gig economy, which is, you know, a very kind of transient type of employment. People work in what we call 0 hours contracts, a very sort of precarious and insecure type of employment. People often moving from job to job. And that has an impact locally, I think. That sense of pride that was once there, you know, where thousands of people had blue-collar jobs in steady, stable industries which had been there for a very long time. That has a real impact, I think, socially as well, economically. And I don't think we've addressed that. I don't think we've addressed that in Britain particularly well. I think it's probably fair to say you haven't addressed it in America particularly well. And we cannot underestimate the consequences that has in local communities. And certainly it's part of the reason why people feel very, very let down by the Labour Party in Britain.
I thought you did a great job in the book in drawing the connection between economics and culture in these working class areas, because we've had a book written here that I've talked about in the past with guests on my show. It was called What's the Matter with Kansas by Thomas Frank. And it basically said that working class people, when they vote Republican, vote against their own interests. I thought you did a very good job in talking about how economic issues are important, but they're not the grand sum of the interests of the working class. You might address that a little more and how you talked about that in the book.
Yeah, I've always found it fascinating, actually, that people on the left, like me, I mean, as you said earlier in the conversation, I'm of the left, I'm a member of the Labour Party, and it genuinely pains me to see some of this stuff going on in Britain. You know, the idea that all you have to do is promise people more money. You know, you can introduce policies and embrace systems like the global market, which have very profound and far-reaching changes and unsettling changes in these communities. And, you know, they have the potential to disrupt social bonds. They have the potential to fracture social solidarity in these communities. But all you have to do, you know, throw more money at them and suddenly people are going to start voting for you again. I think it's incredibly naive and actually shows a fundamental lack of understanding about what people in those communities really desire. And the bizarre thing in Britain is actually it was traditionally the right, the political right, people like Margaret Thatcher, who thought that everything could be reduced to a debate about the economy, that if you just gave people a few extra pounds in their wage packets at the end of the month, they'll support you. And I think what we've seen in Britain in recent years is that idea just doesn't hold. You know,
we saw the Labour Party in Britain preach the gospel of globalization to these communities by saying, oh, look, it's going to increase our gross domestic product. It's going to result in a few pounds extra for you in your salary. And people thought, well, hold on, I'm not particularly interested in that. If you are disrupting everything I've ever known, and if you're bringing enormous and rapid transformation to my community, don't think you can just kind of buy me off with a few pounds. And I think we've moved in Britain from a debate about, you know, the economy and people's material interests, which party can serve those best, to actually a debate now about cultural values. And that almost has become the frontier in British politics. That's become the new divide between people who have that communitarian instinct, have those traditional values, that sense of belonging, that sense of rootedness, and people who think we should just, you know, embrace the new global market, we should embrace open borders and everything that goes with it. And that is where the Labour Party has been left behind very seriously, because there was a culture war going on in Britain, and it didn't realise it, and it didn't realise it was losing millions of people in that culture war. And now it stands, as I said earlier, on the sidelines of British politics, almost irrelevant, and I think that's a tragedy.
You mentioned some of the social issues that are prominent in Britain as well as over here. How do you balance, Paul, we had Barack Obama here talking about the fierce urgency of now in trying to move faster on bringing social justice to many, many groups here in our country. But yet, I thought you were very artful in talking about the resistance to the problem of the scale and the speed of change that happened, especially regarding immigration and some other social issues there. How do those need to be properly balanced? Have you had people kind of respond to you and say, yeah, but this is a matter of urgency to bring about more social justice here?
I mean, it's always struck me as bizarre that the left in Britain is suddenly now so fervently in favour of open borders, because until fairly recently, a position of open borders was actually a fringe position on the left. Most people on the left, people in the trade union movement, people like me, most Labour MPs, most activists on the left understood that the labour supply was really just another market dynamic. And like all market dynamics, it needed to be regulated so as to secure the best outcome for workers, allow governments to plan around housing and employment and welfare and so on. And even in your own country, Bernie Sanders, there's an interview with him on YouTube where he describes open borders as a Koch brothers proposal, how it benefits big business because it allows the rich and corporate bosses to bring in cheap labor from elsewhere and to undercut wages. That position that he articulated was very much the mainstream position on the left in Britain. And now it's almost like a fringe position. If you argue against open borders on the left in Britain, then you're regarded as some sort of nativist and, you know, you get accused of being anti-immigrant and all of that sort of nonsense. And this change has taken place so quickly. And, you know, the disturbing thing is, I think, Ronnie, not just on the issue of immigration, but on all sorts of issues now, positions that were once regarded not so long ago as mainstream positions and entirely legitimate positions in debate have now almost been placed off limits. And people who might articulate those positions are demonized, particularly if they do so and they have any sort of public profile or if they have a position of importance in society. Their career and their livelihood can be destroyed. And, you know, what I say to my colleagues on the left in Britain is, look, we need to be careful because wokeness doesn't penetrate the ballot box. You can force people to be silent in You can try to bully people into not expressing their beliefs. You can try to insist that there's one opinion which everybody must conform to. But when people get in the ballot box, they are free to vote in private. And if they don't like what's going on in society, and if they don't like what their representatives, in this case in the labor movement, have been doing in recent years, then they can vote in such a way where they can send a real message. And that's exactly what's happening happened in Britain. You know, millions of working class people saw the left, the Labour Party, embracing this woke agenda, embracing this sort of socially radical agenda. And it passed them by, and it didn't sit comfortably with them. And they've got their revenge at the ballot box. And this is the danger for the Labour Party, it might not end there. Anybody in the Labour movement in Britain who thinks that it can't get any worse really needs to think again, because I think, as I said before, the taboo now has been broken. And having done it once, they won't hesitate to do it again.
We just have a couple minutes left, Paul. There's a couple things I'm not going to be able to get to, but that just leaves more for folks that are interested to go purchase the book, and I strongly recommend that. But one major change that happened, I mean, again, we kind of follow parallel paths here across the pond, as they say. One major change was the Democrats nominated a more middle-of-the-road Democrat in Joe Biden, somebody that most people in the party felt his best characteristic was he could win. He had the best chance of beating Trump. Labor didn't seem to take that route in 2019. Who do you see the possibility of changes in national leadership coming, of somebody that can kind of espouse the views that you point out that can win over there?
No, I think the danger for Labor, I mean, the current leader of the Labor Party, Sir Keir Starmer, is under all sorts of pressure at the moment, because he recently lost a by-election in a red wall town where Labor, strangely enough, had actually held the seat at the 2019 general election, but then lost it in a recent by-election. I think the problem for the Labour Party is changing the leader at the moment would be, you know, changing the deck chairs on the Titanic, as we say. It's going to need something much more fundamental for the Labour Party to reconnect with the working class in this country. It's going to need an internal revolution. It's going to need a radical overhaul in how the Labour Party thinks and how it interacts with the working class. And whilst the Labour Party continues as a kind of middle-class pressure group, which is effectively what it is at the moment, then that reconnection simply isn't going to take place. And the difficulty for Labour is there are so few people within the Labour Party now who come from that working class background, because it's been hollowed out of its working class influence in many places. And what it is really now is a party for, on the one hand, a kind of middle class liberal left, and on the other hand, the middle class radical left and student activists, and the old kind of blue collar working class element, which used to be a very, very strong part of the party and hugely influential in the party, has virtually gone. So without some sort of internal revolution within the Labour Party, a simple change in leadership is going to make not an ounce of difference, in my view.
Well, I think there's going to be some interesting things to watch from over there that we can learn from, and I'm sure there'll be some things going on over here that on your side of the Atlantic you can learn from. It's interesting just to see this take place and the forces of globalization having similar impacts in similar areas, and I think there's a lot in common here between where we're at here, WVIK, and then where you're at in Britain. So it'll be worthwhile to keep an eye on things over there. My guest today has been Paul Embry, who's the author of a book called Despised, Why the Modern Left Loathes the Working Class. That's been our topic today. And Paul, thank you so much for being a guest and this successfully completed my first international interview here.
Well, I'm honored to be your first international guest, and thank you very much for the invitation. I enjoyed it.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at wvik.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.